Good afternoon. My name is Kayla, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the TSCA Chemical Data Reporting Requirements and E-Reporting conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Ms. Cronkite, you may begin your conference.
Thank you. Hi, and welcome to EPA's webinar on the chemical data reporting. My name is Leslie Cronkite. I work for the Environmental Protection Agency in the Office of Pollution and Prevention and Toxics. I want to thank you all for joining us today. At this point, we have a little over half of the 772 people that have registered, but we're going to go ahead and get going. Before we jump in, I'd like to emphasize to all of you how important the chemical data is to EPA and the public and the quality of that data. And hopefully through today, we'll be able to help you in reporting the highest quality data possible. EPA and the public understand chemical risks based on the data you're reporting to us, and the data also helps EPA set priorities. So in today's meeting, we're going to familiarize you with the chemical data reporting and explain the reporting process. Generally, we'll be going over information that helps you understand whether or not you have to report and the basics of reporting. And as many of you know, we published the chemical data reporting rule last August. As we move through the presentation, we'll highlight the changes as compared to the last reporting cycle. And also, new to this reporting cycle, we are requiring electronic reporting, so we'll describe that process a bit. And overall, we want to emphasize that the quality of the data that's coming in to EPA really starts with you, the people who are reporting. So as we move through this, we hope that you'll get an understanding of how to report. We want to emphasize that gathering your data ahead of sitting down to do data entry is most important and will result in the highest quality data. I want to talk to you a little bit about the logistics of today's webinar, and then we can get started on the meat of the presentation. During the presentation, all the lines will be muted. We won't be taking questions during the presentation. We'll spend about an hour going through the slides, and then we have devoted 2 hours to answering questions that you, the participants, have. We'll take your questions or comments in the order that they're received. Dial star one, and that puts you in the queue. If you decide to withdraw your question or comment, you can press pound, and that will take you out. When commenting, if you would please state your name and the organization that you're with so that everybody can understand who's asking the question. If you need assistance, you can dial star zero for an operator. And in the case that there's not enough time to hear everyone's question during the webinar, you may email us questions to ecdreweb@epa.gov. And that website will be presented again at the end of the presentation. Finally, after the webinar, in addition to the webinar slides, we will be placing a recording of this session on EPA's website at www.epa.gov/CDR. So with that, I will turn it over to Ellie Clark, who will be doing the majority of the presentation today. She's with the Chemical Control Division.
Thank you, Leslie. Good afternoon. I will be covering the agenda topics that you see before you down to 2012 CDR information resources, and we'll then turn it over to Jane Wallace, who will give a quick discussion of e-reporting before we break for questions. As you can see by the agenda, our focus is going to clearly be on preparing for reporting for 2012, and as Leslie said, we'll be highlighting the features that are new for 2012 reporting. I'll then briefly touch on a couple of special topics, which includes the joint submissions, byproducts, and changes. In August of 2011, EPA published the Chemical Data Reporting, or CDR, rule, formerly known as the Inventory Update Reporting, or IUR, rule. To prepare for the next submission period, which starts on February 1, 2012, EPA has developed a variety of informational materials. I'll discuss these further at the end, but just to give you a feel, we have several guidance documents available on our website. Earlier this year, we conducted a webinar to develop the CDR web tool. And following that, we had a preview period for interested stakeholders to try out the ECDR web tool at the end of September. We've now come to today's webinar, whose slides are already posted. Subsequent to this, we also have additional documents that we hope to publish later this month. Just to remind you where the CDR rule came from, EPA created the Toxic Chemical Substances Inventory in the late 1970s. This was to be a comprehensive listing of chemicals in commerce in the U.S. Therefore, chemicals have been added through the new chemicals program in the PMN notification or pre-manufacture notification. Thus, we currently have a list of over 85,000 chemicals. Subsequently, EPA created the Inventory Update Reporting Rule in 1986. This was first used to collect updated information on manufacturing and is now collecting updated information on processing and use of a subset of TSCA-listed chemicals. In August 2011, as I said, we updated the IUR rule. At the same time, we changed the name to Chemical Data Reporting, or CDR, rule to clarify that this is a data collection rule. However, we will continue to use IUR to refer to the 2006 and earlier submission periods, and we will use CDR to refer to the 2012 and subsequent submission periods. To remind you of the value of the CDR data to EPA and others, EPA considers CDR data to constitute the most comprehensive source of basic screening level exposure-related information on chemicals available to EPA. This will help EPA, other agencies, and the general public develop an understanding of potential chemical risks. It also provides the American public with greater access to a wide range of information on those chemicals to which their children and families may be exposed to every day. In particular, EPA needs both hazard and exposure data for day-to-day work under TSCA. We needed to prioritize chemicals for further assessment, to assess data needs for particular chemical substances under TSCA Sections 4 or 8, and to inform risk management decisions made under TSCA Sections 5 and 6. This slide presents the 2012 CDR in a nutshell. I'm going to discuss most of these topics in more detail in the next few slides, but just to give you an overview, manufacturers, including importers of TSCA inventory listed chemical substances manufactured for commercial purposes with a 2011 production volume of 25,000 pounds or greater at a site, are subject to CDR reporting unless they're otherwise exempted. The next submission period runs from February 1st through June 30th, 2012. All submitters this time will be required to use the new ECDR web reporting tool, and which they will access through EPA's Central Data Exchange, or CDX, to create and submit their Form U electronically. The Form U is the EPA form used to submit the required CDR information. EPA will no longer accept paper submissions or other electronic media, and submitters must first register with CDX to access the CDR web. Because we've been getting a lot of applicability questions, I'm going to walk through the EPA-recommended process for determining your need to report. Detailed coverage of this topic can be found in our Instructions for Reporting document currently on our website. The reporting requirements have changed so that if you reported under the 2006 IUR, you need to look at the 2012 requirements because reporting may be required for chemical substances that you haven't previously reported on. We suggest that you consider the following steps to determine whether you're required to report for each chemical substance that you domestically manufacture, including import, during calendar year 2011. Under step one, you determine whether your chemical substance is subject to the CDR rule. Under step two, you determine whether you are in fact a manufacturer who is required to report. Under step three, you then determine what information you must report. Just a reminder that the instructions document is guidance as well as these slides. The ultimate source for CDR reporting is the regulatory text at 40 CFR Part 711. As part of the August 2011 final rule, EPA created a new Part 711 devoted solely to the CDR reg text and moved in IUR-related reg text that had been previously housed in 40 CFR Part 710. This is a decision logic diagram from the instructions document to assist you in determining whether you manufacture a CDR reportable chemical substance under Step 1. Each of the questions below is identified by a letter. The next few slides review points to consider under each of these questions. The first question to consider under Step 1, Question A, is your chemical substance manufactured for commercial purposes? Under the CDR rule, a chemical substance is manufactured, including imported, only if it is manufactured for commercial purposes. New for 2012, EPA has modified the definition of manufacture at 40 CFR 711, and I just want to note here for those of you paying close attention to the overheads that we have a slight error, and the slide reads 40 CDR 711.3 instead of 40 CFR 711.3. It's not that far off since the Part 711 is devoted solely to the CDR rule. However, the definition of manufacture now includes extraction of a component chemical substance from a previously existing chemical substance or complex combination of chemical substances, as well as contract or toll manufacturing, which involves co-manufacture of a chemical substance by the toll manufacturer and the contracting company. For the CDR rule, key features of the definition of manufacture for commercial purposes are that it means to import, produce, or manufacture for a commercial advantage, and it includes substances produced coincidentally during manufacture, processing, use, or disposal of another substance or mixture, which would include byproducts separated from the other substance or mixture, as well as impurities that remain in the other substance or mixture. While byproducts and impurities may or may not themselves have a commercial value, they are produced for the purpose of obtaining a commercial advantage since they are part of the manufacture of a chemical product for commercial purposes. The next question, question B, is determining whether your chemical substance is actually on the TSCA inventory. There are several ways that you could go about to determine this. The public TSCA inventory is now available on EPA's website under our new chemicals program. This will tell you, this will give you chemical substances whose identity is not considered confidential, as well as generic identification of chemical substances whose identity has been claimed CBI. We actually recommend that you use the second choice here, the EPA's Substance Registry Service, or SRS, database. This is the easiest way to get chemical information on for a variety of chemicals because it has the regulatory status information, including TSCA inventory status. I'll be referring to this later when we discuss company identification. Company records may also be searched. You may have letters regarding TSCA inventory status. You may have previous IUR submissions, or you might have commenced pre-manufacture notice substance information. Another point to consider under question B is the fact that although mixtures are not reported to CDR, the chemical substances that make up a mixture are potentially subject to reporting. In this case, when a mixture is imported, you would need to determine the inventory status for each component chemical substance. On the other hand, if you domestically manufactured a mixture, you would need to determine the inventory status for any component chemical substances that were formed from a chemical reaction that occurred as part of manufacturing the mixture. If you cannot determine the TSCA inventory status of your chemical substances, you may contact the TSCA hotline for assistance. Moving on to question C, once you've determined that your chemical substance is on the TSCA inventory, you need to determine whether it's potentially eligible for any exemptions from reporting. There are five TSCA inventory groups that are largely exempt from reporting. They are polymers, microorganisms, certain forms of natural gas, naturally occurring substances, and water. At 40 CFR 711.6A, you can find the specific definitions for each one of these groups. If your chemical substance is not in one of these groups, at this point you can move on to step three, two. However, if your chemical substance is in one of the groups, you need to consider question D under step one before moving to step two. Question D asks, is your chemical substance ineligible for exemption? With the exception of naturally occurring substances, chemical substances must be reported if they are the subject of any of the following, even if they're otherwise exempt. This would be a rule proposed or promulgated under TSCA Sections 4, 5A2, 5B4, or 6. An order issued under TSCA Sections 5E or 5F. Relief that has been granted under a civil action under TSCA Sections 5 or 7 or new for 2012, an enforceable consent agreement under 40 CFR Part 70. Appendix B of the instructions document provides lists of substances subject to these actions. However, if you have trouble making this determination, you can also contact the TSCA hotline for assistance. If you determined in step one that you manufactured a CDR reportable chemical, you move on to step two, and here's a decision logic diagram to help you determine whether you are a manufacturer who is required to report. The first question under step two, question E, asks whether you manufactured, including imported, a 25,000 pounds or more of your chemical substance in 2011. As usual, you need to evaluate each chemical substance separately for each site that you report. The 25,000 pound reporting threshold is for the principal reporting year of 2011 only. This is the same threshold that was used for the 2006 IUR reporting. We have had some questions about how 2010 production volume figured in here, but I want to emphasize here that both of our reporting thresholds are based on production volume in the principal reporting year only. For example, if your 2010 production volume for a chemical substance is over 25,000 pounds, but your 2011 production volume is less than 25,000 pounds, you do not meet the reporting threshold for the principal reporting year and therefore do not have to report. If you both domestically manufacture and import the same chemical substance, you would add those values together to determine your production volume at a site for calendar year 2011. As we said before, mixtures are not reportable, but their components may be. So you would apply the 25,000 pound threshold to each domestically manufactured component chemical substance or to each component chemical substance in a mixture, and you would apply questions A through E to each one of these components. These next two questions relate to small manufacturers. Under question F, you could be considered a small manufacturer and possibly qualify for an exemption for a chemical substance if your total annual sales for 2011, and this would be combining yours and your parent company sales, if they're less than $4 million. If your sales are over $4 million, you could still possibly be eligible if your total 2011 annual sales are less than $40 million and your annual production volume is 100,000 pounds or less at a site. Related to this is the question about whether or not you might not qualify for a small manufacturer exemption if your chemical substance is subject to certain regulatory actions. And these actions are a subset of the actions I discussed under question D. In this case, it would be a rule proposed or promulgated under TSCA Sections 4, 5B4, or 6, an order in effect under TSCA Section 5E, or relief granted under a civil action under TSCA Sections 5 or 7. You can see that it is possible to be eligible to use the small manufacturer exemption for some chemical substances or some sites and not others. So you must review these questions for each chemical at each site. If you weren't eligible for the small manufacturer exemption, you might be eligible for some of the exemptions under question H. You are exempt from reporting under CDR if the reportable chemical substance is solely manufactured in small quantities for research and development, imported as part of an article, manufactured under any of the circumstances identified in 40 CFR 720.30 G and H, such as impurities, non-isolated intermediates, or by certain byproducts, or you manufactured, including imported, and within 1 year of the start of the submission period, you submitted all of the information required by the CDR rule in response to another rule promulgated under TSCA Section 8A. For example, a preliminary assessment information reporting, or PAIR rule. If you manufacture a CDR reportable chemical substance in amounts of 25,000 pounds or more in 2011 and don't qualify for any reporting exemptions, you may use this decision logic on this slide to determine what information you must report. Basically, if you answer yes to questions I or J, you are subject to full reporting. And with our Form U, it has three basic parts. Part one, company and site information. Part two, chemical and manufacturing information. And part three, processing and use information. So all three parts are considered full reporting. If you answer no to questions I and J, and yes to questions K or L, you are eligible for a partial exemption, which means you only report parts one and two of Form U. The next few slides review these questions before I turn to focusing on Form U. Under question I, did you manufacture, including import, 100,000 pounds or more of a chemical substance? This value of 100,000 pounds is new for the 2012 submission period and will be used only for 2012. It applies, as I said, to the principal reporting year, and you evaluate each chemical substance separately. So that if you manufactured 100,000 pounds or more of a reportable chemical substance in calendar year 2011, you're subject to full reporting. However, if you manufacture over 100,000 pounds of a reportable chemical substance in 2010 and less than 100,000 pounds in 2011, once again, you do not meet the reporting threshold for processing and use in the principal reporting year and are not required to complete Part 3 for that chemical substance. Under question J, chemical substances with the exception of naturally occurring substances that are manufactured in amounts of 100,000 pounds or more are also subject to full reporting, regardless of any exemptions, if they are subject to any of the regulatory activities listed on the slide. And these are the same regulatory activities discussed in step one, question D. Questions K and L are two partial exemptions. As I said before, a partial exemption means that only parts 1 and 2 of Form U must be completed, regardless of production volume. Under question K, if your chemical substance is listed as a petroleum process stream at 40 CFR 711.6B1, it is partially exempt from CDR requirements. If your chemical substance, on the other hand, under question L, is listed at 40 CFR 711.6B24, EPA has determined that there is a low current interest in CDR processing and use information, and this chemical is also partially exempt. Working through steps 1, 2, and 3, you have determined that you have a reportable chemical substance, or a manufacturer who must report, and you know how much of Form U you need to complete. So I want to turn to a discussion of the parts of Form U. A separate Form U is required for each site. Form U actually has four parts, but Part 4 is reserved for the special case of joint submissions, which I will discuss later. This slide and the next few slides are going to focus on Parts 1 through 3, which are of more general interest. Part 1 is site identification information, and this is reported once for each site. Part 2 contains manufacturing information, and this is required for each reportable substance with a 2011 production volume of 25,000 pounds or more. Part 3, as we just discussed, is the processing and use information, which is required for each reportable chemical substance with a 2011 production volume of 100,000 pounds or more. Also new for this reporting cycle, we are applying the same reporting standard to all parts of Form U. In the past, the known to or reasonably ascertainable by, also known as KRA standard, has always been used for parts 1 and 2. In 2006, readily obtainable was used as the reporting standard for processing and use information. However, with this reporting cycle, KRA is now replacing readily obtainable. And related to this, of course, you may have situations where you need to claim information is NKRA or not known to or reasonably ascertainable. If you do this, you may not claim that report as CBI. Just as a reminder, known to or reasonably ascertainable by is defined as all information in a person's possession or control plus information that a reasonable person similarly situated might be expected to possess, control, or know. KRA information includes, but is not limited to, information that may be possessed by employees or other agents of the submitting company. These employees or other agents may include persons involved in the research, development, manufacturing, or marketing of a chemical substance, and KRA information may include knowledge gained through discussions, symposia, and technical publications. Although some inquiry outside the organization might be needed, this would be limited to filling gaps in the submitter's knowledge. Submitters are not required to conduct new or additional customer surveys. However, if there is an existing survey in your files, it would generally be known to or reasonably ascertainable like any other information in the company files. Moving on to the details of Form U. Part 1 covers site identification. Under parent company, new for this year, we are asking that you indicate the highest level parent company in the U.S., and this is defined in 40 CFR 711.3. We are just then generally asking for the company name, address, and Dun & Bradstreet number. Also new this year, site definition as it is the site definition is newly defined in 40 CFR 711.3, and it is defined to specifically indicate that importers must report a U.S. address for their site. This could be a company headquarters, or if there is no company headquarters in the U.S., it can be the agent who is authorized to accept service of process for imports. Additionally, when manufacturing under contract, the site is the location where the chemical substance is physically manufactured. As usual, we require upfront substantiation of CBI claims, and in this case, when you check the CBI box, the substantiation questions will be automatically triggered for you to answer. We also, as usual, require technical contact information. The reporting tool is set up so that you may have multiple contacts so that you can have the best person to answer questions for each chemical substance. Turning to manufacturing information, under chemical identification, new this year is the fact that we are requiring use of EPA's Substance Registry Service, or SRS, database. When you're in this part of the report of the form in the reporting tool, you will be able to connect to SRS directly to identify for non-CBI chemicals the CAS registry number or the Chemical Abstracts Index name, for CBI chemicals the TSCA accession number and generic chemical name. Also new for 2012 is the fact that PMN numbers may no longer be used. However, if you know your PMN number, there's a crosswalk within the SRS database to allow you to identify the appropriate names. Upfront substantiation of CBI claims continues to be required for chemical identity, and these questions will be triggered. A manufacturer whose supplier won't reveal the chemical identity of a substance may use the joint submission process to ask the supplier to provide the identity directly to EPA. I will touch on this further in a later slide. Turning to chemical production volume for the 2011 principal reporting year, we continue to require the production volumes for the domestically manufactured and the imported. However, new for this year, we are asking you to indicate whether the chemical is physically located at the reporting site or not. We're asking you to report the volume used at the reporting site, and this replaces site limited. And we're asking you to report the volume directly reported from the reporting site, and this would be directly exported from the reporting site without any domestic processing or use. Also new is the fact that for 2010 data, we're asking you to give us one data element, and this is the total production volume, which would mean you would combine domestically manufactured and importing if you deal with both. Continuing with manufacturing information, we're also asking for the number of workers that are reasonably likely to be exposed. However, we're not asking for a solid number. We're asking you to select codes for ranges of workers that we have listed. Similarly, for maximum concentration, which is measured by percent weight, we're asking you to select codes for concentration ranges. New this time, we're asking you to indicate in a checkbox whether your manufactured chemical substance is being recycled, remanufactured, reprocessed, or reused. And we are continuing to ask for the physical forms and the percent production volume in each form. Turning to part three, processing and use information. We are asking you to report information for your site as well as for domestic sites which receive the chemical substance. As I said before, this is based on the 2011 production volume, whether it's 100,000 pounds or more. New this time, we're asking that all CBI claims under processing and use require upfront substantiation, and those questions will be triggered when you check CBI. Under the industrial processing and use data section, we're asking you to report codes for unique combinations of type of processing or use, industrial sector, and industrial function category. New this time is that we've substituted a new list of 48 industrial sector codes for the North American Industrial Classification, or NAICS codes, which we previously used. But we do have a crosswalk of the industrial sector and NAICS codes so that if you know your NAICS code, you can find your IS code. For each of these unique combinations, we're asking you to report percent production volume, number of sites, and number of workers reasonably likely to be exposed. For consumer and commercial use data, we're asking you to report product category codes, and we have a list of 33 revised category codes. For each of these product categories, we're asking, and new for this time, we're asking you to distinguish whether it's a commercial use, a consumer use, or both. We're also asking whether it's used in products intended for children, the percent production volume, maximum concentration, and new for this year, the number of commercial workers reasonably likely to be exposed. Descriptions of these codes are in Appendix D of the instructions document. You would check a not applicable box if you do not need to complete Part 3. For example, if you have a partial exemption and you only need to complete Parts 1 and 2, or if one section doesn't apply in your situation. For example, if a chemical is fully reacted during industrial processing and use, you would check the not applicable box for the consumer section. This concludes the review of general 2012 reporting. I now want to touch on a couple of special topics. I've mentioned joint submissions before. Joint submissions are allowed only when a supplier claims the chemical identity is confidential and the supplier will therefore not disclose to the manufacturer, including importer, the chemical identity. Participants in joint submissions all must submit electronically, so they all must register with CDX. They could include a primary submitter, who is the manufacturer, who requests that a supplier directly provide EPA with the Form U Part 4. The secondary submitter, who is the supplier who may voluntarily submit the chemical identity in Part 4 directly to EPA, or might have to ask its own supplier to complete Part 4 as a tertiary submitter. The requirement here is for the primary submitter to request that a secondary submitter complete Part 4 and send that information to EPA. However, completion of Part 4 by a secondary or tertiary submitter is voluntary. If, on the other hand, as a result of initiating a joint submission, the supplier decides to tell the manufacturer the chemical identification, the manufacturer would then revert back to use of a single submission and not a joint submission. Just a few comments on byproducts. As I noted in slide 8, under step 1, question A, byproducts are included in the definition of manufacture for commercial purposes. Byproduct is also defined as a chemical substance that is produced without a separate commercial intent during the manufacturing, processing, use, or disposal of another chemical substance or mixture. The instructions document contains a decision logic diagram for byproducts, similar to the ones that you've just seen, but it focuses strictly on byproducts and can be used to substitute at step 1, question A, for determining whether a byproduct is manufactured for commercial purposes. The decision logic walks through these three questions. Did you manufacture a byproduct for commercial purposes? Is your byproduct then used for a separate commercial purpose? Or is your byproduct exempt from reporting because its only commercial purpose is to be burned as fuel, disposed of as waste in a landfill or for soil enrichment, or to extract a component chemical substance from the byproduct for commercial purposes? As a reminder, we have a special question and answer document for byproducts on our website. We are also developing a training module specific for byproducts, and we are exploring dates to meet with a group organized to discuss case studies for reporting byproducts. Just a quick review of 2016 changes. The major differences are in application of the reporting thresholds. The submission period for 2016 will run from June 1st through September 30th, 2016, and the principal reporting year will be 2015. However, this time, 25,000 pounds will be the sole reporting threshold for all parts of Form U. And we also have a new exception. The reporting threshold will be 2,500 pounds for chemicals subject to the regulatory activities that I previously discussed under questions D and questions J. Additionally, important to consider is the fact that the need to report is triggered not by simply the principal reporting year. It's triggered by meeting the 25,000 pounds or the 2,500 pounds in any calendar year since the last principal reporting year. And for the 2016 period, this would mean 2012 through 2015. Related to this, there's a new data requirement for total annual production volume to be reported for each complete calendar year since the last principal reporting year. This concludes the basic review, and I wanted to discuss some information sources before I turn this over to Jane Wallace to discuss electronic reporting. As we've already noted, the webinar slides are already available on our website. We also have a resources page which contains the instructions document, which I've been referring to. It also contains a question and answer document specifically for byproducts. On our About Submissions page, we have information from the September 2011 webinar on e-reporting and the September 2011 version of the schema for the CDR web. Additional items that we will be adding to the resources page are CDR training modules, a large general question and answer document, and some case study documents. You can send questions to ecdrweb@epa.gov, and you can also contact the TSCA hotline at tsca-hotline@epa.gov. As I said, before I take questions, I would like to turn this over to Jane Wallace, who has been working on developing the e-reporting for 2012.
Thank you, Ellie. I'm Jane Wallace, an IT specialist and the project manager overseeing the development for the CDR application. The EPA understands you as submitters for the CDR hold a unique perspective to the system and would like to thank you for participating on this and previous webinars. We would also like to thank those individuals that participated on the week of industry testing. I'm going to spend the next couple of minutes giving you an overview on the electronic reporting aspect for the CDR. The CDR will leverage the EPA's Central Data Exchange, CDX, which serves as a point of entry for environmental data submissions to the agency. It allows for the filing of electronic forms, which can be submitted instantaneously instead of mailing paper forms. And it allows you to receive agency confirmation when the submissions have been received. The application has been designed with your confidential business information needs by providing a secure environment that uses a 256-bit digital encryption within a secure socket layer, which is a standard for e-commerce applications, two-factor authentication in CDX, which uses the username and password combination, as well as a 25-1 series of questions. That is 20 questions where you select five of which you provide an answer to, and one question will be selected from those five to verify your identity. And a passphrase that will be used at the Form U level. You create this passphrase when the form is started and can be shared with those individuals that have access to the form. But you need to be mindful of the fact that this passphrase cannot be retrieved or reset by the help desk. This serves as an additional measure of security to ensure that that unauthorized individuals cannot access the information on the form. Please remember that if you and your team forget this passphrase, the form information cannot be retrieved and you will need to re-enter the CDR information into a new form. All these security measures add up to an environment that is more secure than the security measures currently available on your online banking. The application was designed to automate validation of CDR data and generate a copy of record that will also serve as an acknowledgement of the receipt of the Form U. The CDR has the following features which assist in the preparation of the Form U. Form U can be completed in more than one session. The CDR can be saved at any point throughout the entry of the data, and a user will be able to return to the form at a later time. For companies with their own data collection processes, the CDR allows for direct data transfers through the ability to upload an XML file. Amendments to previously submitted 2012 Form U's can be completed by unlocking a previous submission, making the necessary changes to the form, and then submitting the form as you had previously done. Please note that if you unlock the form, changes are made, but then those changes are not submitted, the form has not been amended, and the EPA is not aware of the changes that you intend to make. Joint submissions can be completed separately by the manufacturer and supplier, as Ellie has described. In the case of a joint submission, a manufacturer will be able to identify this case, and the system will generate a unique identifier that should be shared with the supplier, also known as a secondary submitter. If the secondary submitter finds that they're in a similar situation and need to create a joint submission, a tertiary, the application has the ability to accommodate this case by the sharing of the same unique identifier that was shared with by the manufacturer. In these cases, the EPA will be able to pull the information together from these different manufacturers and suppliers, but these companies will not have access to each other's information through the CDR. I'm now going to show you a few screenshots of the application that highlight some of the features that have been mentioned so far. You will get to the Chemical Information Submission System landing page after registering in CDX. From this drop-down, you will select the Chemical Data Reporting, CDR. You will be taken to a screen where you can manage previous 2012 CDR submissions or create a new one. Here, we would like to point out that previous submitted CDR is noted as having a status of submitted, a copy of record is available to be downloaded, and there is a lock icon under the action. To create an amendment, you click on the lock icon, enter your passphrase, and then you can click on the site name to edit the form. Please do not forget to submit any changes that you made, otherwise the EPA will not get the amendment. When you create a new form or edit an existing, there's a general look to the site that you should be aware of. The left-hand navigation tree allows you to quickly jump to different forms of the different sections of the form, add a new chemical, create a joint submission, or upload your XML. Please note that the XML upload is intended as a one-time upload of information. So if you start entering data into the form, then upload the XML, the screen data may be replaced by the XML data. On the bottom of the form, you can see icons that allow you to validate the data that has been entered into the form, save the data that you have entered, preview the form U in a PDF format, and submit the form to the EPA. At the top, you can see the Home, Forms, User Management, and Resources tab, which will always be available to you. Please make sure to save your data before moving off the page that you are on. As Ellie noted, we leverage the Substance Registry system, so you will not be able to enter chemical information that is not valid. If you are using the XML upload capabilities for the chemical information, the validation will check to ensure that the chemical is valid and flag those that are not. In these cases where the chemical is not valid, you will need to manually verify those chemicals that are marked as invalid against the Substance Registry system. Thank you again for taking the time to participate in this and previous webinars. Now we would like to open up the phone lines for questions. Please note that if a question cannot be addressed adequately by the large volume of staff that is in attendance, we will ask you to email your questions to ecdrweb@epa.gov. Kara, moderator, can you open up the lines for questions?
Sure. At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. We will pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Your first question is from the line of Neela Bachu.
Hi. My question is regarding the various sites that we have entering the data. In 2006, they submitted their forms, completed forms to me, and then I entered everything into the site for filing. How can I do that now to assist my other sites? Can I still send them a form template to complete and send in, or do they have to go in and enter the data from their end?
Each of the different sites can enter the form individually. Or if you want to take care of it all, you can create a Form U for each of the different sites.
Do you have a Form U template?
You can
what you'd be looking at, this is Van Tranley, I'm contractor to EPA. What you'd be looking at, there's an extended role within the application itself called a support role. And what that allows you to do is as you go through and you create your different sites, a support person would be able to log into that specific site, fill out those components of information, and then log out so that eventually when the company comes back to submit all the breadth of information, they're able to do it from there. So you wouldn't necessarily have to ship back and forth forms to answer that. You would, if you're as a prime, you want to enable that functionality, or someone who's supporting would like to engage in that functionality, be able to log into the application directly and complete that. If you want to stick with your existing method, then I think you will have to take a look at how do you get that information back and forth to each other via email or via paper. But the application itself allows for extended web capability so that a person who is not directly involved can log in and submit their information.
Right, but do you have like a template set up in the event that they don't want to go in and do the support role?
Well, one alternative for you would be is to do the preview. So you would generate a principal format of what you have started, and you can send that out to have it filled out by each of the individuals.
Okay.
But someone will have to enter it through
okay,
the electronic tool.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Thank you. Your next question comes from the line of Arun Samshwar.
Hey, Arun, go ahead.
Hello, do I speak directly into the phone?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, sorry. Arun Samashkar with the National Council of Paper Industry. My question is, if you have a particular byproduct which you may burn as a fuel solely, but also export based on market conditions, then how would you take the byproduct exemption that's available for burning something solely as a fuel? The example would be, you know, turpentine or, in our industry, tall oil soap, which, depending on the market conditions, could also be burnt in combustion devices as opposed to being solely exported for other uses.
Rune, that's a very good question. We have a couple of scientists conferring at the moment. All right, Arun.
Hello, this is David Barrell from General Counsel. The exemption at 720G is, I think you're referring to,
right,
is where there's the commercial purpose is solely for burning, and
right,
sounds like a question like that's not the only commercial purpose here. And so if there are other commercial purposes, then to the extent those apply, you can't use the exemption that is solely for burning.
So do you report the entire amount, even though, let's say, half of it is burnt as a fuel? Or do you only report the portion that is? I understand the exemption doesn't apply to what you, it's not the sole purpose, but then do you also report the entire amount that was burnt as a fuel as well as exported? And that goes for any byproduct. For example, even combustion ash, if you beneficially applied it for soil enrichment, but you also sent it off-site to build concrete blocks, then you got the same problem, you know. In one case, it is exempt. In the other case, it's not. So does it negate the exemption for all of the byproduct? That's the question.
Arun, that's a very good question. We don't have consensus in the room around here. If you can go ahead and email that question to...
Yeah, I'll do that.
Thank you so much, Arun.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your next question is from the line of Amanda Henderson.
Thank you. Go ahead, Amanda.
Hi, yes. My name is Amanda Anderson. I work up at Memory Tech. I am just wondering if we produce a solder paste that is used by other manufacturing facilities only. Is that from reporting because it's not for, you know, public use?
Amanda, we're having a hard time hearing your question. Can you repeat it, please?
We produce a solder paste that is used in other manufacturing facilities. Would we be exempt from reporting since it is not? It is used at other manufacturing facilities as an end product for the public, but not here. We don't sell it directly to the public in any way.
Amanda?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, we're having difficulties finding out what you need. Is this a sulfate that you're manufacturing being sold to other companies and you're asking whether or not you need to report it?
Right, it's a solder paste.
Solder paste?
Yes. And it may be sold to other companies, but we don't sell it directly to the public.
Yes.
Yeah.
It is something that you manufacture, correct?
Right. We manufacture it, but we don't sell it to the public. To companies.
Yes. If you manufacture a product and sell it to anyone, you're manufacturing it for commercial purposes.
Okay,
if you're manufacturing and selling it to other industries only, then you might not need to fill out the commercial and consumer use portion of Part 3, assuming that you manufacture 100,000 pounds or more of this substance.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's my last question.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your next question is from the line of Travis Willard.
Hello.
Hey,
Travis. Hi. My question is regarding the extraction of a substance from a mixture. I think it was on slide 8 of the initial presentation. You know, if we had a mixture of, let's say, X, Y, and Z, we've produced them, we store them in a tank. Obviously, the individual volumes of X, Y, and Z are reportable. But if we choose to distill out Y separately and sell it, is it reportable again as additional volume?
Yeah. Travis, thank you. That's a very good question. Unfortunately, we don't have the right people in the room to answer that particular question. If you don't mind emailing that to ecdrweb@epa.gov.
Yeah, I'll be happy to.
Thank you, Travis.
No problem.
Thank you. Your next question is from the line of Robert Ulasic.
Hey, Robert.
Hi, Robert Ulasic, Tahoe Partners for Axa Nobel Surface Chemistry. My question is on e-reporting. We're planning to do all of our reporting by, you know, generating XML and uploading that to the interface because of the volume stuff that we need to do. I was wondering if there was a final XSD and example XML files for this. I'm not sure that existed when we were doing the earlier testing sessions.
The final XML schema is available on the website.
Okay.
It should be right there on the IUR. If you click on the right section under new information, there's a link there to the information, and about halfway down the page is the XML schema. It's not an example, it's the schema itself.
Okay. What I had done to make an example before was I, with the test interface, added a couple chemicals and then submitted and exported, and then I got an example of what I was doing. I just didn't know if you had any other examples besides doing it that way.
That's certainly one way to go about it. the XML schema should be straightforward enough for your IT staff to go ahead and pull the information that you need into it.
Okay, last time I am the IT staff, and last time that XSD had a lot of to be determined in it. So I will go check it again and contact you if you have problems.
Travis, I hate to ask you this. When was the last time you looked at it? I'm sorry, Travis, are you still there?
Just Robert asked the question.
Oh, I'm sorry, Robert. When was the last time you looked at the schema?
I will have to say that was probably at least a month ago.
Yeah, it should be the same version. So I'll, if you could go ahead and email ecdrweb at epa.gov, I'll try to see what I can do to help you through this.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And our next question is from the line of Tom Gannett.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Hi, Tom.
Thank you. I'm DuPont, from DuPont Packaging and Industrial Polymers. And I want to be clear on this, on how you do the reporting for isolated byproduct streams. That in this case would be a byproduct stream that you don't produce particularly for commercial purposes. It's just a waste stream. But you want to recover a starting material that is present in that mixture. And so you, the recovered starting material that you would feed, that you feed back into the start of your processing would be reportable. But would the byproduct stream that you've isolated before purification of the raw material, would that be, would that mixture be reportable as a mixture, or would it be reportable as each individual component, or not reportable at all?
This is David Barrell from General Counsel again. The byproduct questions are very context specific, so I do suggest sending those in by email.
This is, yep, thank you.
Thank you. And your next question is from the line of Eric Ozen.
Go ahead, Eric.
Your line may be on mute. If you would please unmute your line.
Sorry. Good afternoon. Right now, we submit an annual report on a Form R to EPA for the lead that we process here a year. How does the new CDR report differ from that existing Form R, and does it replace it?
Eric, please confirm which is the Form R for TRI?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Hey, Eric. Yes, that is a different reporting requirement.
Okay. So far we've seen it's about the same information, so we didn't understand what the difference was. Okay, next question. We talk about importing and exporting. Imported chemical substances, exported chemical substances. This is a really dumb question here. I'm assuming this means from out of the country into the country for import, not just bringing something from, say, Texas to California?
Yes, correct.
Okay. Nextly, your PowerPoint presentation was very good. Can we download that, or where can we go to see that again and not be subject to time?
The PowerPoint presentation itself is currently available on the IUR website, so it's www.epa.gov/CDR.
Okay. We have already, at this time, taken a look at the COSCA inventory of chemicals, and you write there's about 85,000 of them on there. There's a lot of them that seem to be rather benign. Is there a separate list of substances similar to Rojas substances and or REACH substances of very high concern?
For the purposes of CDR reporting, we're looking for information for chemicals produced over 25,000 pounds, and we're not limiting it to chemicals of concern or the kinds of lists that you're talking about with Rojas and REACH. This is a general, we need general information
okay.
for our assessments.
Okay, I think that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Eric.
Thank you, and your next question is from the line of Barbara Volk.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, Barbara, go ahead.
Great. I believe I heard the first speaker say that in Part 3 of Form U, a manufacturer is required to share information on exposure and use on their site in the U.S. and those of other sites that may use this substance. I'm thinking of this as similar to the downstream user site. Could you clarify if I understood that correctly? And if that's the case, how does a company obtain information about use by customers or downstream users?
You are correct. Under processing and use, we are asking for you to report activities at your site as well as domestic sites that receive the substance from you. We do recognize that not everyone will have detailed information on this, and we're asking you to apply the known to a reasonably ascertainable standard to determine that information. You might have reports or information from some of your customers that you can glean information from, but if you don't have the information, you can use the NKRA or not known to a reasonably ascertainable to indicate for your downstream reporting.
Thank you.
Right, if it's not known or reasonably ascertainable to you.
Yeah.
And next reporting period in 2016, does that standard of KRA change?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Your next question is from the line of Betsy Duncan.
Yes, hello. I have a question concerning impurities on slide 8 and slide 16. There seems to be conflict the what has to be reported and how you identify impurities. So can you clarify reportability of impurities?
We're looking at the two slides right now.
Yes, hello. If you look at slide 8, it says that the definition for manufacture for commercial purposes defined in 40 CFR 704.3 includes impurities. However, on slide 16, we're using an exemption in 40 CFR 720.30 G and H to exempt certain kinds of products, including impurities, from the CDR rules. Basically, it just means that we're using a general definition of manufacture for commercial purposes that does include those, but since we don't want them to report under CDR, we're then imposing an exemption for the impurity. So that if you're manufacturing an impurity, you do not have to report under CDR for it.
Okay, thank you. I have another question concerning CDX. For example, I'm registered for CDX to submit a PMN. that same registration login and ID would work for that same company and site for the CDR. Is that correct? That drop-down box will now include the CDR choice?
Correct. For those people that are registered under the TSCA flow, which is now currently used for the PMN, when the CFPP submission type is available through CDX, those users will be automatically copied over to the CFPP flow, which will be used for the submission for the CDR.
Thank you.
One point of clarification?
Yeah, as part of that copying over, that means you'll be able to use the same login and password that you use now. You will still need to register for the CSPP data flow, meaning you need to go in and add another data flow to that. Being a previous user already, what that gets you out is you do not need to be identity proof by mailing in any information or going through LexisNexis to do that. So it's really just you go, select the data flow, you electronically sign up with an e-signature, and then you're then prompted to go into the application itself.
Will your password and login be the same?
That is correct. You're saying you'll still be using the same username and password. You would just be entering, you'd be selecting from a different menu choice.
Okay, but there will be a next step is what you're saying.
That is correct, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And your next question is from the line of Krishna.
Yeah, Krishna Parmeshan with ASARCO. I had three questions, you know. The first one had to do with, I thought in earlier this thing there was something about some data on 2010, but in today's presentation, I don't think I saw anything on 2010. Is there any data elements that require 2010 reporting, you know?
Yes. Do you have the slides available, or have you looked at the slides?
I'll have to go back to it, you know.
Okay. If you look at slide 24, when we're discussing chemical production volume, we indicate that for 2010, we are asking for one data element, which is the total production volume for calendar year 2010.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas all the other data is for the principal reporting year, which in this case is 2011.
Okay. The second question, again, following, you know, if you're registered for TRI, does the same answers hold? You're using CDX? Does the answer just given hold? If you're submitting TRI through CDX, you know.
Yeah, if you're, this is Van, if you're submitting, if you're already logged in and registered to submit for TRI, then similar to what happens with the existing eTSCA flow, you don't have to be identity proofed again. You'll need to select CSPP from the list of data flow choices, and then you'll need to just basically register for that by e-signing on that page. You'll be able to use the same login credentials that you currently use for TRI, which is a separate program from the existing one that you're looking at, so there's no cross data share on an application front right now.
And so you still have, as the previous call questioner said, there'll be an extra step to go through.
That is correct. The extra step you'll go through is literally clicking on CSPP and then saying, I verify that I am this person. What you do not need to do is mail in registration information again to identity proof yourself and authenticate who you are. You really just have to click a couple times, and then you're going to be deposited into the correct application.
And the last question I had was, you know, we talked about impurities. That is, it is in the definition of manufacture, but there is an exemption that says, you know, you don't require CDR reporting. Similarly, for byproducts, I guess, if it's being sent out to a recycler and they are extracting and a metal out of that, would the same analogy hold?
one of you guys?
Well, if you're extracting a chemical substance that is itself present in the byproduct, or if your recycling company is going to do that, then the byproduct stream is considered exempt from reporting. However, if the chemical substance, by extraction, you meant that there had to be a chemical transformation of some chemical component in the byproduct to get it into another chemical substance, like reducing a metal salt down to a metal, elemental metal compound, that would not be considered extracting. In that case, the byproduct would be subject to reporting, as well as the metal that was obtained from there.
So if I understand that correctly, then if it is used lead and a recycler of lead is kind of that is different from, say, maybe a lead salt like lead sulfate or lead hydroxide, and the recycler is making lead metal out of that. The two would be looked at differently?
That's right.
Okay.
Thank you, Krishna.
Thank you. And our next question is from the line of Mac McAllister.
Hello?
Hello, Mac.
Yes, I have two questions. First one related to exposure under Parts 2 and Part 3. I believe in the prior reporting scheme for 206, and the exposure was to be independent of personal protective equipment and engineering controls. In other words, regardless of what PPE was being used, you had to assume a hypothetical exposure. Can you comment on that, please, for this new one?
Yes, the calculation for exposure has not changed. It is similar to what you did for 2006.
Okay.
And it's in the details of that are in our instructions document.
Okay, good. Second question, you talked about recycling materials. Scenario is that a company purchases a solvent which they use for extraction. Then they distill and recycle that solvent. Is anything reportable?
Come in. We'd like to ask you to submit that question electronically to the ECDR web at epa.gov.
Yes, will do. Thanks.
And your next question is from the line of Gustav Ragrero.
Hi, this is Gus Ragrero from Sunoco. I have a couple questions concerning export and import information. In the instructions at the special provisions for importers, it talks about using or having corporate report as a site for importing materials. In that situation, and that is similar to what we do, corporate controls the imports basically, but the imports go to the refineries. What should the refineries report for importing? Should they exclude that or note or duplicate that information?
Okay. Yes, hello. If your corporate is the site controlling import, then you would be the ones that reported importing the substances, and the refineries that receive it would not need to report, because the headquarters is reporting for everyone. It's a little bit different than the way we treat sites for domestic manufacturing.
Okay.
We only want one report.
I got you. And if the plant controlled the importing on their own, then they would indicate their importing.
I'm sorry, we got a lot of static. Could you repeat the question?
That's probably this headset. If the plant controlled the importing, they would then indicate the report information for importing at that plant.
Yes, that's true. Any plant that is controlling the importing would then be the importer and file the form.
Okay. Now, similarly, similar situation, the question is around export information. That's new on the form. There wasn't instruction about that, you know, this example of corporate versus the plants. So in the case of the plants, they are making the material being exported, but corporate may control the export. So would that export information go on the corporate form?
With respect to exporting, we don't have the same requirements as we do for importing. For exporting, we're looking at the amount of material that is directly exported from a site. We're looking at exposure at that site. So you wouldn't treat it as the same as you do at import. You would report for each specific site what is exported from the site.
Okay. An export is sold directly from that plant to another country.
Well, what we're asking for is in that specific data requirement is the direct exporting, which means there's no domestic processing in use before it's exported.
Okay. And one last question. There is a definition for importer in TSCA, but I could not find one for exporter. Is there an EPA definition for exporter?
Gustav, we're looking that up right now. Make sure we get the verbiage correctly to you.
Okay. And I can send the email as well, the same question.
Well, why don't you send that question in by email so that we don't waste everyone's time while we page through our notes.
Very good. Thank you. That's all my questions.
Thank you. Your next question is from the line of Fred Marashi.
Hi, this is Fred from Chevron Phillips Chemical Company. Is the procedure for our managers at the facilities to sign up on the CDX on the website and under resources, and is the procedure final and they can go ahead and sign up?
No, the CFTP flow that will be used for CDR is not currently available.
Okay.
They will be able to sign up December 1st.
Okay, great, thank you. And that would be in the resources section? Hello?
I'm trying to figure out how best to answer your question. Are you asking where a link will be provided?
Yeah.
Yeah, when we get the communication out of when it's available, it'll be in our IUR, CDR webpage.
Great, thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. Your next question is from the line of Chitam Bara.
This is Chitam Bharatanu Pillai from Karas Corporation. My question is regarding the reporting requirements for toll processing facilities. For example, our facility manufactures a chemical substance A. A portion of it is also manufactured in, say, two toll facilities. One probably is less than the threshold and another more than the threshold. So I understand that the CDR is specifically for each site. So does it mean that the toll processing facility has to file a CDR, or is it the responsibility of the company who contracts that production? And also, if a toll processing facility manufactures, let's say, 15 different chemicals for 10 different chemical companies, is that the toll production facility's responsibility to file the CDR for all those chemicals?
We're caucusing on an answer, so hold on for just one more minute.
Can you send that question in by email, please?
Sure, I'll do that.
I'll make sure we get it right.
Thank you.
Thank you. And your next question is from the line of Stephanie Casarino.
Yes, hi. I had a clarifying question to a previous question that was asked by the woman about whether solder paste is reportable under CDR, and I believe someone had answered that if you manufacture a product, then you have to report. I thought it was if you manufacture a chemical and that a product or an article is exempt from CDR, meaning that the solder paste would be exempt.
Hello, are you talking about processing a product versus manufacturing it?
I'm talking about the question that was asked about this company that manufactures, that makes solder paste.
Okay.
Whether they have to report that solder paste under CDR.
This is David Farrell again from General Counsel. If you're making a product without manufacturing a chemical substance, then you wouldn't be subject to reporting. What triggers the basic activity that triggers reporting is manufacturing a chemical substance.
Stephanie, did that make sense?
Yes. So, and the solder paste would not be a chemical substance.
Correct.
Depends on how you make it.
Well it depends. We can't answer that question without.
Yeah, is that a formulated material? Is it a blend of different chemical substances?
If there's a particular scenario that you need more detailed information on, you should send it in by email. But the critical initial question is there any manufacture of a chemical substance going on here?
Okay. And I had another question in regards to reporting byproducts that are sent for recycling. If that byproduct stream is not on the TSCA inventory, how does a company report the chemical identifying number? Hello, if you believe that you have a chemical product that's subject to CDR reporting, but it's not on the TSCA inventory, you might have reporting obligations under our new chemicals program. However, we would suggest that you contact our TSCA hotline who can help verify whether or not your chemical is on the inventory before you head in that direction. Thank you.
Just for general questions here, we're finding that many of the byproduct questions are very specific for your case. So if you have a specific byproduct question, please go ahead and send it to ecdrweb@epa.gov, and we can answer them specifically for your case.
I'm sorry, can you still hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
I don't think that my question in particular was specific. I think a lot of byproducts that were previously exempt or not subject to reporting will have that problem of not being on the TSCA inventory. So I think that's a much broader question that needs to be addressed.
Thank you. If we can take the next question.
Your next question is from the line of Kathleen Roberts.
Hi, good afternoon. I have two questions. One is related to the exclusion for polymers or microorganisms or the like. I understand that those are exempt from reporting unless they're subject to a Section 4 or 5A2 or 5B4 or all the rest of them. Does that exclusion come into play for the 2012 reporting, or is that later on in the 2016?
Hello? You were talking about the five groups of inventory chemicals which are potentially exempt from reporting. For 2012 reporting, with the exception of naturally occurring substances, these chemicals must be reported if they're subject to any of the regulatory activities that we mentioned. Additionally, in 2016, we're using those same regulatory categories to require reporting at the 2,500-pound level, but that doesn't go in until 2016.
Okay, so, for example, if we have a polymer that is subject to a Section 4 test rule, in 2012 it would be reportable if it was over the 25,000-pound threshold, but in 2016, if it was still subject to the same Section 4 test rule, it would be subject to reporting for the 2,500-pound threshold. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay. My second question is for non-isolated intermediates, which are exempt. Does the same exemptions that we have for Section 5, where you have a case of routine maintenance where there might be a diversion of that intermediate so that you can go in and clean the tanks or whatever, do those same exclusions for routine maintenance or the like apply for the CDR reporting? So in other words, during a principal reporting year, you might have to go in and divert something that is typically a non-isolated intermediate to do maintenance on the processing equipment. Would you have to report that because, you know, it is eventually going back into the feedstock?
Yeah, this is Ken Danipal. The same conditions for the exemption for the PMN rule or inventory would also apply for the CDR rule exemption.
Okay, excellent. And then one last comment, and clearly you guys are very well aware of this, that there are a lot of questions and issues and anxiety around the byproducts reporting, and I know you have a bunch of case studies and we are working to set up a workshop. I think the sooner we can try to get something lined up where people feel comfortable that they understand where the reporting obligations lie, the better off we'll all be. So thank you in advance for your attention to that, and I appreciate you taking my question.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you. And your next question is from the line of Zalouk Zaghez.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
I had a question on one of the chemical CAS numbers, particularly petroleum slope. And in this case, what we call slope oil here is, say we produce naphtha as a byproduct, and we have an off-spec naphtha. It goes into that tank. we keep off-spec things in that tank and then redistill it back into the units to recover what can be recovered. Is that a product? Because since we're reusing it in the system, would that be a product? Do I have to report that? Since we're not, it's something you make off-spec. It's not something you plan to make, but the product, it just comes off-spec.
This is another byproduct question, which I think should be sent in to email. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Your next question is from the line of Julie Longway.
My question has already been answered. Thank you.
Right.
Thank you, Julie.
Your next question is from the line of Felipe Pierre.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, Felipe.
Okay, I have a question regarding the CDX registration. The previous IUR, I had registered and submitted via CDX. Do I have to re-register for this one? That's my first question.
You will have to register for this data flow. Now, I want to clarify, when you say re-register, what you do not have to do as part of registering for this data flow is you do not need to come up with a new username or password. You do not have to re-enter your identity information into the system. Depending on what data flow you are registered for, we'll be able to cross-leverage that information. Specifically, you said, could you repeat again what data flow you had previously used or are currently using?
We used, I had registered and submitted the IUR previous.
If you registered and submitted IUR in 2006, then yes, you will need to re-register. Your password will have expired. 4 years is a long time, or 5 years is a long time to keep it on record. So you should re-register and go through the identity proofing.
Okay. The second question is regarding CVI chemicals. We import a lot of chemicals, and some of them are CVI chemicals, and the identity is not disclosed. Neither is the CAS number. At times, we are getting accession numbers. Now, if we do not have any identity which we can use in order to ascertain that it's listed on the inventory, do we have to ask the foreign supplier to submit the information on our behalf? Do we have to have them register and be a co-registrant, I guess that's the question.
In cases where you have a TSCA accession number, you would go ahead and report with a single submission for like any of your other chemical substances. However, in cases where you don't have any information about the chemical, maybe only have a trade name, then you would be someone who would use our joint submission process, where you would file as the primary submitter and you would fill out all the information in parts 1, 2, and 3 that you can, and then you would ask your supplier as a secondary submitter to send to EPA directly the actual identity of the chemical substance in the joint submission. So I recommend you look at our slide on joint submissions is slide number 27, and we also have a detailed discussion of joint submissions in our instructions document.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your next question is from the line of Georgine Adams.
I have a question about reporting by site. If a parent company owns two business units that are located next door to each other at the same physical site, but treat themselves as separate businesses that got different EPA numbers, different EPA facility numbers, file different TRI reports, et cetera, do you want them to file one form under CDR?
No, we wouldn't ask you to file one form. The form U is on a per-site basis, so we expect that many companies will have a variety of sites, and we want you to fill out a form U for each site and the chemicals that are used there. So it sounds like in your case, the company would file two separate form U's.
Even though they are basically right next door to each other, there's just a fence.
But they're operated differently, right? They're controlled differently. You said they have different D&B numbers or different TR reports.
Yeah.
So they're really functioning separately.
Okay, great. Thank you.
And your next question is from the line of Philip Ostrowski.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Philip.
Hey, my question has to do with KRA. Okay, there's lots of information that we don't know at this point in time. We sell chemicals to a distributor, okay? That distributor more than likely is not willing to share information with us. So we have to document that we've asked the question somehow under KRA.
No, there's not a record-keeping requirement under this rule with respect to companies' determinations that they did not know something or could not reasonably ascertain something.
Okay, because, see, a lot of many distributors will not divulge their customer list because they're afraid you'll go to them directly. So.
The rule itself does not impose a requirement to for people to document their due diligence.
Okay. Now, the other question has to do with number of workers that are exposed to these chemicals in the various scenarios. Okay. That's going to be extremely difficult for most of us to ascertain.
If you don't know it and it's not reasonably ascertainable, it need not be reported.
Okay. All right. That's it.
Thank you. Your next question is from the line of James Hudson.
Oh, hello. It's James Hudson with Cargill. Our question is, we are importer of record on gasoline cargoes, finished gasoline. Is this part of the reporting? Finished gasoline and like Euro grade blend stocks.
Chemicals in question are included in the list of partially except petroleum process streams and other chemicals, and then and only then you would have the partial exemption. So the partial exemption is chemical specific. You have to find the substance listed there.
Can you explain the partial exempt?
There's a list of petroleum process streams in 40 CFR 711.6. B1, and they're listed by CAS number. If you look up if you happen to be listed on that for that exemption, that means you would only have to report parts 1 and 2 of Form U, which basically means you wouldn't be reporting processing and use. If your substance is not on that list, then it would be subject to reporting if it meets the other requirements for production volume, et cetera.
And then we have another thing we can say is gasoline, probably a mixture of several individual chemical substances, and those would have to be found on the list in order to be partially exempt.
So if we import a gasoline cargo and any of those chemicals are on that list, it is partially exempt.
That's true.
Which would then, we don't have to do parts one and two?
Right, for those.
But only the ones that are partially exempt. If you have a mix, if you import a mixture and some of your chemicals aren't on the partially exempt list, then you would need to file parts one, two, and three for them.
So we just can't list it. I mean, just as a just basic gasoline, you got to break it down per chemical?
Well, we're not sure how you would be representing gasoline. We're not sure whether there would be one chemical substance identity that would completely apply to it, or whether it would be a blend of different petroleum process stream components. So depending on the correct chemical identification, that's what you would have to look up on the list of partially exempt chemicals.
Okay, I'll go look at the list then. Thank you.
Thank you. Your next question is from the line of April Ezerepi.
Go ahead, April.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was on mute.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, good afternoon. My question is regarding accession numbers and PMN numbers. I believe I heard you say that accession numbers are acceptable on the form, and then PMN numbers should no longer be used, but there's a cross-reference back to the SRS to look up the chemical names that are associated with the PMN numbers. We have, you know, some of these PMN numbers from many, many years ago, and I'm a bit concerned that we may not find the information in the SRS on that. So what other avenues do we have to obtain chemical identity information that is acceptable in the CDR?
You are correct that we are asking for accession numbers now and not PMN numbers. We have put a crosswalk of PMN numbers. I don't know if you've checked to see whether any of your PMNs are listed there and give you an accession number, but if you do... Hello?
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
But if you do check the SRS and you can't find it, then we would recommend that you contact the TSCA hotline.
Oh, so the PMN numbers are referenced in the SRS now?
Yes.
Yeah,
oh.
They should cover all the PMN chemicals, because we update that twice a year, but it's updating that includes all the past listings.
Okay,
so
very good. I'll go there and look. Thank you.
Thank you. Your next question is a follow-up from the line of Ron Sawar.
Yes, I'm back.
Good to hear from you again.
I'm not going to ask any byproduct questions, although I have a ton of those. But the question I have deals with, you know, you guys call chemical substance for complex things like combustion ash and sludge and everything. So we've got a situation, and that can apply to many so-called chemical substances, like black liquor, for example, that's generated at about 14% solids. In other words, it's got 86% water. But in the process, it's concentrated up to 75% solids. So what is the amount? The CAS number and the description of the chemical does not include a percentage in the definition of moisture or whatever. It just says spent pulping liquor. So what should the production volume be? Is it of the final concentrated substance or the initial, or is there any guidance on that? I know, for example, if whatever is exported, you have specifically said it's the at the point of export, so that's very clear. But within a facility, if a chemical is not defined with the percentage of moisture in it and it goes through concentration and you have to report the volume production, what would you recommend?
If you are removing some of the water before the black liquor is processed,
right.
I think you can not count the water that you removed from the weight of the material.
Okay, so if the water is removed by concentrating it from 14% solids to 75%, at that point it is processed. In other words, it's burnt in a recovery furnace and the chemicals are recovered. So you would say to report at the 75%, including the 25% moisture in it. Is that right? Or is it just the 75% solids and not the water in it either?
Well, if the removal of the water is a separate step carried out before the incineration part?
Correct.
One more on that question.
I'm sorry, we need to consult a little bit more on that question.
Sure,
Arun,
sure.
If you don't mind emailing that to ecdrweb@epa.com.
Yeah. All right, we'll do that. Thanks. Bye.
Thanks.
Your next question comes from the line of Tim Elliott.
Thank you. This is Tim Elliott. I have two questions. The first one, are there planned changes to the XML schema based on the pilot?
No, all the changes to the XML schema have been completed.
Excellent. Thank you. The last question is, will the agency continue to work with companies one-on-one with any XML download issues?
We can help support specific questions regarding some of the XML. I think it's a question of the nature of the question with that XML, and I think that's where we have to take a look at it on that point. But, yeah, we will be able to be reached via help desk. I think it's a question of how do you want to parameterize those questions and specifically the approach that you're taking to XML consumption and exporting into the tool. There's going to be some support for it, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your next question comes from the line of Tim Millenziffer. All right, Tom, your line is open.
Tom, are you on mute?
The next question comes from the line of Larry Bradford.
Hello, this is Larry Bradford. I'm with ME Global. I got a very simple question, and that is the reporting year for your products, if it meets the criteria, is strictly for 2011. Am I correct?
Yes, you are. The principal reporting year for this reporting cycle is 2011, calendar year 2011.
Okay. I was seeing 2010 in there in some cases, but that pretty much answers my question. Thank you.
Yes, we just want to clarify that 2010 may have been mentioned in the proposed rule, but in the final rule we indicated that the principal reporting year would be 2011, but that we would ask for one data element for 2010, and that is the total production volume for 2010. But that in no way affects determining reporting thresholds this time. The principal reporting year is the year you look at to determine whether you need to report.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Larry.
You're welcome.
Your next question is from the line of Chai Nguyen.
Sorry, Chai, can you go ahead?
Yes, I have three questions.
When will the tool really be available? You mentioned that the registration starts December 1st. When will the tool be available?
We're aiming to have the tool available in early January.
Okay. The next one is, you know, can we get answers to the unanswered questions?
We will be formulating a Q&A that we will post on the CDR website.
Okay, so those examples that they have that are maybe similar, that's why we're not asking them again. Correct? You post them?
What we will have is a general Q&A that will address the questions. We are formulating that based on this.
Okay, thank you. The third question is that will the SRS be updated for the 2011 PMN submissions?
Yes,
it'll be updated.
Okay, yes, thank you. That's it.
In January, it'll be updated.
Your next question is from the line of Travis Willard.
Hi, this is Travis Willard with Ascend Performance Materials again. Back on the byproducts issue, but a general byproducts issue. You know, byproducts are exempt from PMN requirements if their only commercial purpose is to be burned as a fuel. That's one of them. But wanted to ask if that included a byproduct which is sold to another company for them to burn as a fuel, either domestic or internationally. I guess the conference is occurring.
Yes, I'm sorry. Each time there's a delayed response into the question, we are conferring on a response.
Okay.
You have a very layered question. Sorry, Travis. As I said, this was a very layered question. If you could email your question to ecdrweb@epa.gov.
Okay. Yeah, I'll do that as well. And then the second one is in the instruction document. You state it's 4746 that we're to report the production volume directly exported and not domestically processed or used. And we have certain chemicals that we export through traders, where there will be a transaction in the U.S., whereas basically the transaction is we sell it to another company in the U.S., they put it on a ship and ship it overseas. So we aren't the exporter, but it is exported, and is that something that we should report in that production volume exported portion, or should that be in the domestic volume portion?
Hello. As long as the product that you're exporting goes directly to someone who is going to ship it out of the country and it is not being repackaged or in any way changed, then it would not be domestically processed or used.
Okay. Well, I mean, there is repackaging involved because we're moving it from, a domestic river barge to an ocean-going ship. So in that case, I mean, it is going from one type of package to another within the U.S.
Well, repackaging is considered processing in use. If you look in our industrial processing in use section, one of the types of processing or use categories is repackaging.
Okay. All right, then go ahead.
Thank you, Travis.
All right, thank you all.
Okay.
Thank you. Your next question is from the line of Devin Millions.
Hi, yes, my question has to do with the SRS, the Substance Registry Service. Under the statuses and regulation section, it used to refer to, or it does refer to now, TSCA IUR exempt. Can we assume that that is the equivalent of TSCA CDR exempt, and is that going to be updated at some point?
Yes, okay. Yes, that will be updated in the January update. We update, we send information to SRS to update from TSCA twice a year in January and July. So we will be doing these updates in January.
Okay, that's great. And then I guess by that we could also assume that the XU flags that are called out in NCI or SciFinder or something like that, that we can also assume that those are referencing the same thing. They say they're inventory exempt. We just assume that it's the same thing as CDR exempt?
I don't think outside sources would be as authoritative as the SRS will be.
Okay, that's fine. I'll use the SRS.
Your next question comes from the line of Carla Thomas.
Hi, this is actually Bob Ferguson. I'm with Carla. This is the word DuPont. Just a follow-up question on the SRS, and then I had some questions about the recycled, remanufactured, reprocessed, and reused box. When you say the SRS is going to be updated in January, how will we know when it has been updated so that we can be assured that we will find the more recent PMM information?
Hello, we don't have a way via SRS to indicate when it's updated, but the only thing we can tell you is that it will be completed by the February 1st opening date for the submission period.
Okay. So we've talked quite a bit about byproducts and recognize that there's a lot more guidance that's needed on byproducts, but there's also very little guidance in the instructions, at least as they stand now, on when you check that, what we call the 4R box, and wondering if there's going to be additional guidance specific to that. And then I had a couple of specific scenarios I wanted to ask about. But first of all, will there be more guidance specific to scenarios when you check the box or not?
Hello, if you look at the preamble to the final rule published on Tuesday, August 16th, the Federal Register site for that would be 76FR50816. If you actually look on page 50845 in the bottom of the third column, we have a discussion of the data element, identify whether a chemical substance is to be recycled, et cetera. We discussed that, the comments we got, as well as why we believe that this is appropriate and how you should use it. So I would recommend that you look at that preamble.
Okay, I have. So let me ask you a couple of specific questions then. Is the box to be checked regardless of where that remanufacturing or reprocessing might occur. So, for example, in a scenario where I'm manufacturing at my site this chemical, and at some other site where there's no manufacturing, there's reprocessing that occurs, do I check that box even though that activity hasn't occurred at my reporting site?
Yes, regardless of where the processing of rework, I mean the remanufacture use, recycling, wherever it's done, check the box.
Okay. And then my last question is, like a scenario where let's say I make a material and 99% of what I make I go ahead and sell directly, but I've got 1% of that that's off spec for some reason. And all I do is a little bit of purification and rework that 1%. Do I check the box? Because obviously you're not going to be able to tell whether whether that applies to more than that small amount of my production or the entire volume. Okay. Thank you.
Your next question is from the line of Larry McCaskill.
Yes. The question was asked earlier. I didn't quite understand the answer, but are all the questions and answers that have been asked today going to be posted on the CDR website?
We will be formulating a frequently asked questions based on this conversation, and it will be posted on the CDR website.
Okay. Thank you.
Audio on this, right?
Your next question is from the line of Robert Napolitano.
Good afternoon. Simple question for starters. I copy my facility from 2006 and I save it. Is it as simple as like Microsoft Word, save as, and rename it?
No, it's not that simple. You will have to enter the data using the reporting tool, or if you have a method to export to XML, you can leverage that capability.
Okay. Instructions for the reporting are found on the EPA website or on the CDX website?
It's available on the EPA website.
Okay, on downstream reporting, I'm a chemical distributor like several other people, and I have multiple types of industries that we resell to. There's no way that we can really get accurate information. Are you working with the National Association of Chemical Distributors to try and get some kind of standard answer for that question, or just do we put, we don't know?
For chemicals that you manufacture, we're looking for using the known to or reasonably ascertainable by standard. And the reason, and we've also asked you to indicate for industrial and for consumer product codes, because you may have more information for one product code or one industrial code, set of codes for your chemical substance than others. So you report your information to the extent you know it for the different places that your chemical substance goes.
That's the SIC codes, the NASIC codes is what you want?
Yeah, well,
for
industrial processing, we're asking you, we've actually got a set of three, for industrial processing, we have a set of three codes. The type of processing in use, the industrial sector code, which replaces the NAICS codes, and the industrial function category. And we ask you to do combinations of those three codes for each of your industrial settings.
Okay, so I'm just repackaging. That's my industrial setting.
Yeah, there's a type of processing in use for repackaging. And then the other codes are for the different industries that you might repackage and send to.
Okay. In the 2010 data, I kept hearing this term, one data element. Could you expound on that, please? What is one data? Is that one chemical or one? Tell me what that means, please.
Okay. Each piece of data that you're reporting is a data element. On the form U, there will be a place where you report it, one spot where you report the total production volume for 2010. One data. That's one data element. Whereas for 2011, we have divided it up into a bunch of data elements. We've separated out domestic manufacturing, importing, et cetera.
Okay, so I'm only importing and repackaging, so that's my data element?
Data element is each individual question.
Responding to each individual question that we have.
Right. To determine whether or not you have an obligation to report, you look to what you did in 2011. If you have an obligation to report, among the data that you'll need to report will be information on what you manufactured, included, imported in 2010.
Okay. If I'm toll repackaging for a customer, and you're probably going to tell me to send this in as a question, I don't own the product. I provide repackaging and logistics services. I do not own this product. Do I report it, or does the owner of the product own it?
Are you domestically manufacturing or importing the product?
Domestically importing it.
Wait, are you making it?
This is really an export question. I'm sorry. I'm a toll manufacturer, like I said. We don't own the product, and they export it overseas. Who does that part of the reporting?
I think we should send this question in by email. That way we can be sure of getting the correct answer.
I knew that. And again, on articles, if it's an article, we haven't changed it, we haven't repackaged it, we haven't reformulated it. It comes in as an article, which is in a box, a package, and then goes back out overseas. It's still an article. It's not in this loop, right?
Yeah. Chemical substances present in articles. That is, if you import an article, you do not need to report the chemical substances present in the imported article. They're exempt.
Okay. Maybe I'm confusing the issue. I thought I heard people talking about exporting before. Is that typically not part of the IUR in the past? Is that correct? So is export part of this new reporting functionality?
Export is not an activity that triggers an obligation to report. However, if you do have an obligation to report because of your manufacturing activities, which include importing, then you may need to report information relating to exports.
Okay. So I have two sites. I do two different chemicals at each site. Each site has to report the chemicals that they process.
No, processing is not a trigger for a reporting obligation. The triggers for reporting obligations under the CDR are domestic manufacturing and importing.
Yeah, I've made the jump that I've imported it from, we'll make it simple, I'm bringing it in from Canada. I bring sulfuric acid into one plant, I bring toluene to a different plant. I report toluene from one, it's all ordered by HQ headquarters. Do I report for each site the toluene from one site separate, or do I roll everything into one under headquarters? Do you understand my question?
Is headquarters controlling the import, or is each site doing its own importing?
Headquarters makes all the purchases. They control all the purchases.
Then they're considered one site, and it's one form for with all the information, the toluene and the sulfate.
All right. I'll let you off the hook now. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Robert.
Your next question is from the line of Leah Galmerti.
Hi, did you unmute me?
Yes, we can hear you, Lee.
I also typed my question up for you, basically. Another question about imports. Specifically, it has to do with the import transaction to a terminal company, where the parent company controls the import transaction. So the imports they physically go to our terminals, but we would only need to report one Form U for these imports. So where there's the box where you check the box that says, are these imports physically present at the site? Would you check no, because they are physically present at the terminal site, but they're not going to be physically present at the parent company that controls all the transactions. So we'd be filling out one Form U with all the different chemicals, but the parent company controls everything. Do you follow my question?
Yes, I do. This is actually specifically why we did include the checkbox for whether the chemical is physically present at the site. We know that there are a lot of situations like yours where a parent company is controlling the import, but it's actually going directly to other sites or terminals owned by the company. And so you would, in your case, the headquarters is controlling, they're considered the site of import, and because the chemical substance is never actually at headquarters, you would check the box saying never physically present at the site.
That's what I thought. I just wanted confirmation. Thanks.
Thank you. Your next question comes from the line of Kathy Bishop.
Hello? Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. The question I had really comes down to the reporting window. I wondered if EPA, the reasoning behind placing the reporting window earlier in the year, given that you've changed the principal reporting year to 2011. I mean, I know that this rule was delayed, and when you issued the final rule, since you moved the period for which we do detailed reporting to 2011, I wonder why this reporting cycle is going to begin in February instead of June, as it typically does. Because, I mean, we're going to report on 2011 in detail, but we have a very short window of time to get all our information together.
I recommend that you take another look at our preamble and our response to comments document. We discussed this issue in both places.
Did you? Because I've read that in detail. You've explained why the 2011 report details for 2011 can be done earlier in 2012 than it can be done in 2016.
Wait.
For 2015.
What is the question again?
My question is, you know, this rule has been was delayed, and then when the final rule came out in August of this year, a lot of us were expecting it to come out requiring us to report details about 2010. But when the rule came out, it's requiring detailed reporting about 2011. Yet the reporting cycle is earlier in the year than it would typically be for the chemical data reporting. Typically, like in 2016, we're going to report on 2015, but we don't have to actually do the reports until June. And that's recognizing that it takes several months to pull together information on imports and chemical manufacture and downstream processing and use. And I'm just wondering why, with this current reporting cycle, the reporting period is falling early in 2012 when we're reporting details in 2011.
Right. The explanation for the action is contained in the preamble and the response to comment.
Okay. Well, all right. Thank you.
Thank you. Your next question comes from the line of Martin Trimbelli.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you, Martin.
Good. This is Martin Trimbelli from Goodyear Tire and Rubber. My first question concerns importing chemicals, and if we follow the import of chemicals using Incoterms, which are International Chamber of Commerce set of terms that define who the importer of, or which would help you define who the importer of record is. Does it sound like we would be correct if we made our judgment as to who the importer of record of a chemical into the United States is based on the Incoterms that would define who clears customs, which entity clears customs? I can rephrase that question, I think. It's a rather complex one.
Yeah, we're conferring at the moment, so hold on for a minute.
Thanks.
We recognize that in many cases with importers, there are going to be situations where more than one person can or entity can meet the definition of importer. And what we're recommending there, and you can find this at 40 CFR 711.22B, we've said that if several people meet the definition of importer, you may decide among yourselves who should actually submit the report. However, for liability purposes, if nobody submits a report, we would hold everyone liable.
Okay. We absorbed that one, but I'll look at 711.22B, correct?
Yes.
All right. A couple of housekeeping questions from here. We have several new individuals in the company who are likely to need to register in CDX for the first time. And they're not the same people that are going to be submitting Form Rs. Did I hear correctly that CDX report CDX sign up for first timers like these is going to be December 1st? Is that going to be the first date that's going to be available?
Correct. That'll be the first day that it's available.
All right. And then the tool itself would be, I heard, would be available in early January, correct?
Correct.
All right. Last question. Will the website, ECDR web at EPA.gov, will that site be continuously manned through the reporting period? In other words, from now through the through June 30th, so that we can, if we have a specific question that needs an answer fairly quickly, that we can expect that someone will be able to respond to a question that's posed to it within some reasonable time, like a week, 1 week.
Web at EP.
In other words, will operators be on duty to take our call?
We like the way you're phrasing the question. We will have the ECDR web at EPA.gov available, and we will be checking it periodically.
Okay. So other than the TSCA hotline, which will also be tuned in, those are our two resources. That was kind of a question.
Yeah, we started conferring a little bit, but yes, in addition to the TSCA help line, the CDR web at EPA.gov will be available, and we will be checking that periodically.
Okay. The operators will not be on duty.
The operators will be on duty. Just we want to be realistic in our responses.
Yeah, and give them time to sleep. Okay.
Okay.
Great. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
That's all.
Thank you. Your next question comes from the line of Karina Gajil.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, Karina, we can hear you.
Okay, I have a couple questions, mostly with regarding importing of products, and say the product is a proprietary chemical that, you know, once you're reviewing what you imported and you see that the MSDS only indicates maybe 50% of the product, because they only need to, you know, put on an MSDS, the hazardous chemical, or maybe they even only report that as a range, like say 40 to 60%. So if you contact the supplier and ask them for more information on what the chemical is, what the rest of the components are, and they were to say, well, it's byproducts or impurities. They don't want to tell you what they are, but they say that they're byproducts or impurities. Can you just, document that they told you that and go ahead and just report on, the component that you know, and since you are, you're importing it for distribution, you're not going to be removing those byproducts for commercial use. Can you just go ahead and not report those byproducts since you don't know what they are?
Byproducts.
Hold on for a minute. We have to confirm on this one.
All in. Okay. If the manufacturer's byproducts shouldn't be in what you're importing, because if the overseas manufacturer had a byproduct, that would have been removed from the.
Would it be an impurity then?
But if you can claim it as an impurity, as an importer, if that's your conclusion, impurities are exempt from reporting.
Our byproducts can sometimes still be in the chemical itself, and not having been extracted, they're just basically then an impurity. Is a byproduct only a byproduct if you extract it?
If it's something that's unintentionally present in the chemical substance you're reporting, then it would be treated as an impurity.
Okay. Okay.
Our concern is that you are given all the information about all the intended co-products that are in there, not just the main component, for example. So although we could not worry about impurities or byproducts, we want to make sure that you are given the complete information about all of the intended components. Yeah, and you really can't rely on an MSDS as far as.
I think we should be. Why don't you send your question in writing, and we'll get back to you with a written response. So I want to make sure we're providing the full and complete answer to your question.
Okay, because that's going to be a pretty common occurrence when you've imported product and. For all you know, it's just the one chemical. It's a solution with water, but there may be some impurities or byproducts in there that the manufacturer is not disclosing on the MSDS. So, because they may be, say, a range or something. You've got to find out exactly what the percentage is of the actual chemical that is subject to reporting. But what I'm saying is. What is your due diligence, requirement with regard to accepting their word for it that there is no other, intentional chemical added into that mixture, that all that's left in it is really just impurities?
I understand the question, and that's why I would like, we need time to consider that, and we'll get back to you. Please send it in writing to our, to the email.
Okay, I can do that. And I guess along the same lines where, you have a supplier foreign supplier, and they just basically refuse to, or you've asked them and they don't respond, you know, to give you the information or to file a joint submission. Do I understand it correctly that as the importer, your obligation is to ask them to do a joint submission, and if they just don't do it, you've done what you're required to do by having asked them to do it?
Correct. The obligation that you're referring to is where you've asked your supplier to give you the chem ID, and they say, no, I won't, because it's confidential.
Mm-hmm.
And then your obligation is to ask them, following the terms of the regulation, to send that information directly to EPA. But your reporting obligation is not contingent on whether or not your supplier indeed sends that information to EPA. Once you've asked according to the reg, you've satisfied the obligation.
You're only required to indicate in your when you send your form UN, show us that you've asked for that information.
Okay. And then document it by keeping a copy of an email or something like that that you did ask them.
I think it's part of, isn't it? Don't you? Part of the software.
The way the software is designed, if you request a joint submission to a secondary, a unique identifier is generated and can be emailed from the system.
Okay. Okay. I'll take a look at that, see how that works. Because I you know, there's just situations sometimes where your supplier is not willing to give you that information, and they may not be the manufacturer, and you know, may not want to even disclose to you who the manufacturer is to try and get that information out of them. So I guess, you know, it sounds like do the best you can to ask them for the information, and then just report under the report as the trade name and indicate that you're asking them to do a joint submission. You're asking the manufacturer to do a joint submission.
Right, right. You report under the trade name. Now, in the case where you explain where there is another manufacturer where they need to request the information from what we are now calling a tertiary submitter, they can send that unique identifier that you had generated for them to use to another supplier so that they can provide the information by that means.
Okay. And if you do know part of what was in the product, do you report what you know, or do you just do the trade name?
Cool. Yes, you do report what you know.
Oh, okay. So if you do know 50% of what's in it, you can report that component that you imported it.
Correct.
Like a separate line that you would report then? You would report that chemical that you know, and then you would report under the trade name for the rest of it?
Well, right. If there are a variety of chemical substances in the imported mixture, then you report each chemical substance in the imported mixture.
Right. Oh, I get it. Okay. All right. I think that's it then. Oh, just to clarify on the reporting obligation for 2011 and 2010, it sounds to me like if you imported 25,000 pounds or more of something in 2011, then it's that chemical that you have to look and see what you imported in 2010 and report that amount as one of the data elements of the one that you imported in 2011.
Yes, that's correct. The whole focus this time is on what happened in the principal reporting year of 2011.
Okay. Okay, got it. Okay. I think that's it.
Thanks, Karina.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Carol Komen.
Yeah, good afternoon. Does the agency intend that meeting the known to or reasonably ascertainable standard would include internet searches such as a Google search to attempt to fill the information gaps for Part 3 information for your downstream customers? And so is information available in the internet considered reasonably ascertainable?
There's a discussion of that issue in the preamble, including some examples.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your next question comes from the line of Bill Leska.
Yes, my question has to do with definition of a site. Basically, we have a unit that reports into our plant that receives a byproduct from a neighboring plant, and they react it to form a feedstock that feeds our plant. But they're located entirely within the neighboring plant on property that we lease. So since they're not contiguous, can they still be considered part of our facility for the report?
Hold on for a minute. We're conferring.
So the two sites are not contiguous?
No, they're only connected by pipeline.
Yeah, the definition of site includes the tax continuous property unit. So
even if they work under the same D&B number and they still report into the same structure, we still have to consider them a separate site.
Definition says site means a contiguous property unit.
Okay. One other question on byproducts for fuels. If you have a byproduct that's used as a fuel, but it also has a secondary function as a viscosity modifier, can it still be considered just a byproduct that is intended for fuel use?
No, but once it has those multiple uses that are not all exempt, you can't use the exemption.
Right, but the viscosity modifier is modifying fuels that are to be burned.
Hey, Bill, can you go ahead and send that question to ecdrweb@epa.gov, please?
Will do. Thank you.
Thanks.
Your next question comes from the line of Caroline Maselli.
Hi, this is Caroline Maselli from Chemtura Corporation, and my question has to do with manufacturing by contract. We are now considered co-manufacturers along with our toll manufacturer. How do we report? Is it as before where our toll manufacturer did it, or is there a different process now?
Hello, yes. If you check out our regulation at 40 CFR 711.22C, we have a discussion of our intention not for there to be duplicative reporting of with toll manufacturers and the person contracting them. We require only one report per site. So in your case where you're co-manufacturers, we basically leave it up to you all to decide who should submit the report for that site. However, as usual, because of liability issues, both of you would be liable if no one reports.
Okay.
But you can decide who's going to submit the report.
Okay, thank you very much.
Your next question comes from the line of Tom Millensiffer.
Hello, this is Tom. Can you hear me?
Yes, Tom, we can hear you.
I have been trying to retrieve the slides and have been unable to do so. Can you give me again the reference or the site where I can retrieve the slides?
It's the www.epa.gov/CDR.
It's on the home page. And there's a box on the right. It's in the first box, but at the bottom of the first box.
It's at the bottom of the box that announces the webinar.
Okay, www.epa.gov. .gov/CDR.
Correct.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Raul Horton.
Hi, yes. My question deals with byproducts used for fuel. We operate a heavy oil cracker to produce liquids, and as a byproduct, we produce coke on the catalyst. And we burn that coke off to generate steam and also to provide heat to crack the heavier oil. This is my first go-around for Tosca, but I noticed the last time we submitted this, we counted that coke And it looks like to me that's clearly a byproduct used for fuel. And I was just, could you give me some insight on why I need to list that, or should I list it?
Would you please send that in as an email question, please?
Okay, and I got a follow-up, and it may be more obvious of why I can't do that, but we also operate a delayed coker, and that's clearly to produce gas oils and naphthas, and, of course, a huge amount of coke is produced as that. I think the majority of that is sold for power generation to, you know, third parties. Would that fall into the same category as a byproduct for fuel, or is there something unique to delayed cokers that disallows that?
That any substance that is typically used as a fuel is not considered a byproduct, and so it would not be able to use the byproduct exemption.
Okay, even though the process considers it a byproduct.
Well, it's really more like a co-product, just the way it appears to be described.
Pardon?
It seems to be more like a co-product. That is a second product that has a separate commercial use.
Right. Well, for us, if we could operate it and not produce any of it, it would be the best for us. So it's not a desirable product particularly for us. But I see where you're coming from.
Yeah, it seems that if the typical use of that is for fuel, it shouldn't be considered a byproduct.
Okay. But and I'll go ahead and send you the other email, because that's just that coke on the catalyst certainly wouldn't be considered a typical fuel product, I wouldn't think.
Yeah, well, perhaps you can send all of these questions together in the same email. We can consult.
Okay. Well, thank you. I appreciate this forum. For somebody that's new to this whole process, it's an eye-opener for me.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your next question comes from the line of Michael McGeckin.
Yes, my question dealt primarily with inhibitors added to a product that may be imported, and the concentrations are in parts per million. And if that inhibitor is on the list, do you then look to the 25,000 or 100,000 pounds as to whether it's reported or not?
Just to clarify, are you adding the inhibitor, or is it in the product that you're importing?
It's in the product that's being reported.
Imported, yes.
So then the determination of whether you meet the production volume trigger will be based on the percentage that your inhibitor is in the total amount that you're importing.
Okay, so the inhibitor based on whatever the imported is, if it's nominally 15 parts per million, it's the total volume by the in pounds by the percentage, and then if that falls underneath, it's not reported.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Robin Kahn.
Hi, Robin stepped out, but I'll ask the questions in her place. We manufacture a product in the United States, but it's sold outside the country. So do we need to report the end use outside the U.S.?
No, we're only asking for domestic processing and use activities. So once you indicate that it's exported, you wouldn't have other uses.
Okay. Next question. For the number of workers that are exposed to the material, we're fairly upstream in the supply chain. So how far down do we need to report on? In other words, is it just the number of workers at our manufacturing site and a guesstimate for the number of workers at our customers, or do we need to also consider the number of workers downstream?
Okay, for section two under manufacturing information, you consider you're only considering the number of workers for the manufacturing portion. If you if you export your product, then you probably won't have anything else for the processing and use issues if you export it to another country. But for under part three, we're looking at the number of workers exposed during the industrial processing and use activities or during the commercial use activities. So it sounds like you would be reporting the number of workers under part two for the manufacturing aspect of this.
Well, this is for another product or another bunch of products, so
okay.
That are manufactured in this country, used in this country.
Okay.
So you're saying the number of workers that we have to consider is what happens at our site, our manufacturing site, as well as the sites of our customer and their customers and their customers?
Okay, for your particular site, under part two of the form, where you report number of workers reasonably likely to be exposed, you're focusing on what happens during manufacturing. If you do any processing, do processing of your chemical substance, then you would report that under the number of workers for the industrial processing and use. You would also consider under industrial processing and use other facilities that you know about where you send the chemical that also do industrial processing and use. And then under the commercial and consumer section, if you know anything about the commercial uses of this, you would report under the number of workers reasonably likely to be exposed under commercial uses. However, as we've said before, the reporting standard is known to or reasonably ascertainable by. If you don't have that information, then you can't report it.
Right. If you don't have it and you can't reasonably ascertain it.
Okay. So if we're talking commercial use, let's say we make a component that goes into a paint formulation. We don't make the paint. We sell the component to a manufacturer of paints. They formulate it, and then they sell the paint to anyone and everyone. So do we have to consider the number of exposure people at the consumer level, like the person who goes into a Home Depot and buys that can of paint and that they're exposed to the material in the paint can?
To the extent your reason, if you're aware of that information, you'll need to report based on it.
However, if all that you are aware of is the fact that your product goes into paint, you would fill out the fact under the product code for consumer and commercial uses. You would select product code C202 for paints and coatings, and that you might not be able to fill out all of the other parts under that. For instance, you might have to put NKRA for the number of commercial workers. We aren't asking for the number of consumers exposed. We're only asking for number of commercial workers.
Right. Okay. So it would be our customers, our plant site, our customers, and if there is something further downstream commercially.
That you know about.
Right.
If you don't know about it, you can't answer.
And the number is the sum total of all those sites or those categories?
We ask you to give the information per product code. We recognize that people may know some more about certain product codes than others.
No, but I mean for that particular product, as you go downstream, it's
right.
The sum total of our site and our customers.
To get a precise answer, we'd actually like you to send your question in and give us more detail we recognize this number of workers issue can be confusing, so we'd like to give you a good answer.
Okay, and I have one more question. If we recycle a reactant that strictly stays at our plants, what industrial functional category code do we use? Because there wasn't one that really fit that for a recycling of a reactant. And then what consumer commercial product category code do you use? Because there wasn't anything for that either.
Okay, if you're processing a reactant at your site, there is a type of processing in use for reactant. However, if the reactant is never leaving your site, then it won't have a downstream commercial or consumer use. So you would only report for the codes for industrial use, and you would check the not applicable box for commercial and consumer use for that product.
For the code, it would be NA? I'm talking about the consumer commercial codes. There are three codes.
Right.
The industrial function. Yeah.
And I'm telling you that if your chemical is processed as a reactant on your site, then it can't have a consumer or commercial use because it doesn't leave your site.
Right.
So you would put NA, and there will be a box for the whole consumer and commercial use section on the form U for not applicable. And you will check that, and you will not have to fill out the consumer commercial use section because it's not applicable to your product.
But we do have to fill out the industrial functional category code, right?
Yes, you do, because you're processing it as a reactant.
Right. And so right now all I see is that could be applicable is U999 because nothing else fits.
If you put U999, which is other, we're asking anyone that uses the other codes to give us a short written description of what it is they're doing. And this is in order for us to improve our codes in the future.
Okay. Okay. All right, that sounds good. Thank you.
Thank you. And at this time, there are no further audio questions.
Well, thank you, everyone. Yep, this is Leslie Cronkite again. We just wanted to say thank you once again for taking the time to sit with us and for sharing your comments and questions. Hopefully, this has been useful for you, and it's definitely been informative for us as well. As a reminder, questions and comments that we did not fully answer or other questions and comments that you may have at a later time can be sent to us at ecdrweb@epa.gov, up on the screen at the bottom, and we will get back to you as quickly as we can with an answer that's hopefully thorough and addresses your needs. Once again, thank you, and have a good evening.
Thank you.
Thank you. This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.